Okay, good afternoon, good morning. So today we're going to spend most of our time on reviewing for the midterm. Hopefully you have questions. If not, this might be a short class. Probably not what you want if you don't think you're going to ace the midterm. So first, some other issues. So one piece of non-exam quiz-related anonymous feedback. We'll get to more quiz exam-related stuff later. Questions like, how much can we use something like Stack Overflow in the labs? So in the labs, you can work with other students in the class. And given that, we would probably be ridiculous to say you can't really use the web. So you can. We expect you not to ask questions on the web to random people who aren't in the class for labs, including on Stack Overflow. And if you find some information in the lab that doesn't solve the entire problem, then you can use it, cite it in a comment if you have you submit a C file like we did for the memory safety lab. Please do not look for solutions for the entire lab problem. Or at least don't use them. Like, do not copy and paste. Like, if you were doing the bits lab, do not copy and paste a solution for an entire bit fiddling exercise. This is for labs. Homeworks are different. Homeworks, you are not supposed to work with other people in the class, for example. Yes?
During lab, if you were looking up part of the thing with the entire code showed up, and you read it and understood it, and then you kind of
we aren't gonna strictly enforce that because we can't, but you shouldn't be doing that, and you shouldn't be seeking out entire solutions, at least. And understandably, you can't unsee something, but we don't want you to copy and paste it. And we don't want you to be Googling until you find that. It's not an acceptable approach for the lab. But for parts of things, normal people do that. We're not going to tell you not to do that. Yeah?
So just to clarify, with the homework, you can't work with other students in the class, but you can look things up to understand what's happening.
Yeah, you can look things up to understand concepts that aren't the solution to part of the homework.
Gotcha.
If you want to know how pointer arithmetic works in C, you can look up resources for that, for the list homework, but you should not look up how do I append to a linked list and copy and paste that code or something like that. And another piece of non-exam related feedback was, would it be possible to have make recordings that have a speed up option? So you can right click and save and use something like VLC. What actually appears by default is very system dependent. My browser probably has a speed up option, yours doesn't. But if you use some video player like VLC, it has a speed up option. And I find that quite convenient for watching things like lectures. Sometimes I want to go through most of it quickly and only slow down for parts I care about. Okay, so that's the anonymous feedback that's not directly exam quiz related. And next we'll go to something which is also not exam related, but was confusion from last time about bit numbering. So I talked about this in class and people were definitely still confused. So we're going to try to go over this more slowly. So people were confused about why are we saying bits 4 through 8 are the iCode field when it doesn't look like that when you write things down. And I think there's two big sources of confusion here. So one is that in the English language, we write numbers in big endy, and we always write the most significant part of a number first, that digit. And therefore, when we write hexadecimal, we write the most significant part of each hexadecimal whatever we're writing, and usually for YD6 machine code, it's bytes first, just because that's how we do it in English. Whenever we have a number, we want to write it down. The most significant part, the part which affects the value the most, comes first. English didn't have to work this way, but it does. And the other confusion is that ordinarily, we have absolutely no way to care about the order of bits within a byte. So when you're talking about memory, you just have no way of naming bits in a byte, except if you make one up, in which case you could make up whatever. But here, with HCL2D, because we have a way of addressing individual bits with a number, just like we've addressed bytes in memory with a number, we have this problem for the first time. But in normal Y86 code, you can't have the problem because you can't have an address which is half a byte into a byte. There's just no way of doing that. So when we have instruction listings, they've been listing the bytes because that's the indivisible unit, and they've been writing those bytes out in the English language order because we're using English, and not some other system of writing numbers. So the parts of each byte are in English language order, but the bytes are in the order they appear in memory, because that's actually an order defined by the ISA. You can't actually address the individual bytes of the instruction, so we need to keep them in that order. But we've written them in the English order rather than reversing that, because that's usually more confusing when we're trying to talk about the numbers in English. So this means that here, that this first thing here is byte 0. And byte 0 in this table is written in English order. So the most significant part of the byte comes first, just how we write numbers in English. And the least significant part comes last. Even though on our machine, when we interpret numbers, we're always using little endian. So as far as the individual bytes, whether byte 1 versus byte 2, we have that this is the least significant byte, because that comes first in the way our machine orders things. And we didn't reorder the bits here because, you know, the machine, there's no way of getting the individual parts of the byte. Until we had HCL2D, we had no way of doing that. So that means that the second thing that's listed is the least significant part of the instruction interpreted as a big little endian number, because the first byte is the least significant part in little endian, and we have what we've written in English, where the second thing, the second part of the byte, the last part of the byte is the least significant because we're writing it in the English order. And the other part is the most significant part, which is why the thing that's listed first is 4 through 8. So it's in the first byte, so it's between 0 and 8, but it's the most significant part because that's what we happen to write first in English, even though it's not the way we're numbering bits in HCL2D, to be consistent with how bytes are numbered. And similarly, we can talk about, I messed up the slide a bit. We'll ignore the bottom part, but this part is right. So one way of looking at it, another way, is that if we say have push QRBX, the thing at address X plus 0 is the push QF, that's English order, so this is the least significant part, and the thing at X plus 1 is RBXF. Is that we're at, this is the least significant part because we're writing in English order. So the least significant thing comes last in English order, even though in our bit numbering, this is the first bit here, then the A bits, then these bits, then the two bits. And I just misaligned that, obviously. So any questions about how this mapping works and why we were saying bits 4 through 8 with the HCL2D numbering of bit 0 is always least significant? Yes?
When might this be an issue on an exam?
So the question is, when would this be an issue on an exam or something? So we're going to try to avoid having this come up in the exam, except that we might tell you where something is and ask you to like decode something. So it might come up there that will tell you, remember that in Y86, the opcode appears in the most significant bits of the first byte. Given that information, you should be able to figure out, if we tell you something, what the opcode is. So you should be able to apply it then. The main reason I'm going over it, though, is not because we want to test it, but because it's going to come up in HCL2D assignments. Yes? If we will give you all the information about where fields are in an instruction if you need them. We might not give you the full table, but we will tell you like where you can find the registers or the opcode or whatever if you need it for the question. Yes?
Does that mean you have to memorize all the opcodes?
We will tell if you need the opcodes, we will tell you them. we'll tell you the opcodes you need, but we might not give you the whole table. We might just say, give you the information from the table that you need for the question is more likely. Because reproducing the whole table on the exam would take up a lot of space, and we probably aren't going to use most of it. So other questions? Yeah.
So when we used to like change a number from big endian and then represent it as little endian, we'd move 2 digits at a time, correct?
So the question is, when we're converting from big endian, something that's written in English format,
yeah.
I assume is what you mean,
yeah.
To how it's going to look in little endian, you transfer in the units that you can address. So in Y86, those units are bytes. So the bytes are what's are going to be arranged either in little endian order or in big endian order. When we can't address something, we don't have an order. This is a common confusion that comes up. So some people ask, like, what endianness are registers in? Well, they aren't. Because I can't say, give me byte 3 of RAX. There's no way to do that. So there's no way for me to know that there's an order they're stored in, so it doesn't matter. And similarly, we have the same issue with the bits and a byte. Just because we can't address them means there's no endianness. If we could, there would be. So in HDL2D, there's basically an endianness within a byte, because we can address the individual bits. In Y86, there isn't. Yes?
What is CC equal to when we're doing R?
It happens to be 0. We will tell you that if you need to know it. There's a table, and one of the entries is, remember, always, which is also for jump. It's the normal unconditional jump. Yes?
So like for HDL2D, like the bytes are a little endian, and then the bits inside the bytes are also a little endian?
Yeah, the entire number is in, the bits are numbered in little endian order. There's no bytes, actually.
Okay.
Like, if you can't actually say, give me byte 3 in HCL2D, you can only say, give me bits, 24 through 32. So there's no endianness of bytes because you can't address bytes. You can address bits. Whereas in Y86, you can address bytes, but not bits. Yeah. So, what did I describe here? So here, there's not really an endianness. We're just listing things in the order, the bytes, which are indivisible units, as far as writing things in Y86 is concerned, in their order they appear in memory. So, and we've written bytes in the normal English way, which happens to be basically big endian, but we can't. But it's not like when they're stored in the machine, it doesn't matter, right? Because we can't subdivide a byte, except by like shifting or something like that, which where we're deciding how we're numbering ourselves, not the machine is deciding for us, like with how bytes are ordered in memory. So I guess there is endianness on here, and that's in how dest and v and d are stored. And those happen to be a little endian, which you can't get from this chart, but that's the rule we have. And they're little endian, which means that byte 2 here stores the least significant part, and byte 9 here stores the most. So, other questions about this? Yeah.
Here with the why you brought this up. What was the original problem with the whole byte 4-8 thing?
So people thought it should be 0 through 4 because on this picture we've written for the opcode first.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was the confusion. Mm-hmm. And this comes up later. This is also an issue with RA and RB. So RB is the least significant part of byte 1, which is bits number 8 through 12. And this is a very common error that people make when they have our HDL to the assignments later. Yeah?
So would bits 4 through 8 be arranged like for like no-op, would it be arranged like 1000?
For the no-op? So bit 4 is going to be the least significant bit of bits 4 through 8. So yes, so bit 4 will be 1. Whether you in English, you would not write bits 4 through 8 as 1000. You would write it as 0001, because that's how we write numbers in English. We write the least significant part last. Yeah?
So I guess, why is this chart displayed as it is?
So the question is, why is this chart displayed as it is? So the rationale is we want to write the bytes in the order they appear numerically in memory, by address. Like, it certainly doesn't make sense to do the opposite. And within each byte, we had a choice. We could write things in the natural English order, or we could write them in the other order to be consistent with the endianness of things like this. And the people making this chart chose to use the natural English order, because except when you are using something like HCL2D, where you can address bits other than by extract byte 0 and then extract the some bits of it, it doesn't matter. Yeah?
So in HCL2D, like, the different, like, so the opcode will come before the CC code, then which will come before the RA and RB.
So in HCL2D, you said the opcode will...
The order of the different, like, parts are in that same order, but then the bits are reversed?
In HCL2D, the bytes are numbered in the same... The bytes appear in the same order as far as our bit numbering is concerned, but the least significant parts are the bytes, meaning the CC first. CC has the lowest number, and then the opcode has the second lowest set of numbers. Yeah?
So if we want, like, for IRMQ, the entire encryption, the V, like, the console would come first, and then it would be...
But the bytes still come in the right order, because it's least significant. We're numbering from the least significant part, and we're treating it as a number where bytes are in the first byte is least significant.
Okay.
And so, for IRMOVEQ, this V is still bytes 2 through 10, or exclusive, and it would still be bits 2 times 8 through 10 times 8. And it happens that because HCL2D always treats sort of numbers as little endian, that you'll get the right number out.
Okay.
Because it's always reading the bytes as little endian.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, since push Q, it says A0. So that's 2 bytes.
That is 1 byte. So this each of this is a hexadecimal digit. That's 4 bits. Because 16 values is 4 bits. So this whole thing I have a square around is 1 byte worth. And that's why we have this confusion. If our opcodes were actually 1 byte long, we wouldn't have this problem at all. You wouldn't care. The only issue is that we're squeezing multiple things into 1 byte, which we only can address with one number in Y86, but not in HCL2D. Okay, so hopefully maybe that's all the questions about this. So a brief note on HCL2D on the exam. We might have you read HCL2D just as a substitute for giving you a picture of a circuit if we decide that it's easier to do with a written description of it than a picture. We're not going to have you write or debug HCL2D. Okay, so other things. So the material for the exam is lectures, labs, homeworks, readings. Technically all could be on there. And the format, so it's 75 minutes. It's like prior exams. So it's multiple choice or a short answer. Short answer is like one number. It's going to be 20 to 25 questions. It's during lecture time. It's closed books, notes. There's no cheat sheet, nothing like that. So as a note, on prior exams, if you look at them, there are questions on floating point. We will not be asking any questions about floating point. This was covered in the course in some prior semesters. It is no longer covered in this course. We have decided that you had enough in 2150. So please don't worry about that. So if you want to figure out what's on the exam, here's a non-exhaustive list of topics. If you want to have a good idea, you should look at the schedule. This is basically what we do when we make the exam. I avoid having firm list of topics because I don't want to have a thing where we ask one question and I forgot to list it, even though it's almost certainly something that we covered in lecture. And it's probably going to be just one question on something which is not on the schedule as a topic explicitly. So any questions about what's a fair game for the exam, formats, logistics? Yes?
So you had x86 and y86 written on there?
Yeah.
Can you sort of explain that and to what extent will be
We might expect you to read AT&T syntax, x86 assembly, which is not valid y86. Like things which use the addressing mode with more than one register, or something which uses instructions, which we will probably tell you about if they're something strange like shift or something like that, that aren't in y86. Shift LEA we might have on there. That would probably be the extent of it. Yeah.
Bit fiddling, are you going to ask a similar question to the lab and homework this week?
So the question is, for bit fiddling, is there going to be similar to lab and homework? So we may have questions which are similar to that. They will not be as difficult as the most difficult questions on the homework, and certainly not the most difficult questions in the lab, because you have 75 minutes, and also no C compiler. I guess in x86 assembly, we might use the x86 like comp test, that sort of thing, which doesn't exist in y86. Yeah, back there.
When you say basic circuits, does that mean like
multiplexers and stuff? So basic circuits, I mean things like multiplexers, how registers work, how the clock signal works with the registers, and other state elements we've talked about in our sequential processor. Yeah.
How well are we expected to know the sequential processor architecture?
You should be able to figure out pretty much all of it.
But we shouldn't have a weak recommendation.
What?
We wouldn't be asking you
to. We might ask you questions like, we skip ahead, which are like, which effectively ask, like, which thing is this muck selecting for this instruction?
What would that be?
Depends on the instruction. We'll ask you it in a way which is like, for this instruction, like what, we might ask like, what's the input to something, or what's connected to what? What instructions need this connected to this? We might ask those sorts of questions about it. I think this is something you should be able to figure out from having a general knowledge of how we constructed this architecture. We're not going to have you just draw it whole cloth for a variety of reasons. Like, it's not practical to grade that. But we do expect you to actually know this pretty well, especially since this is a lot of the course for the next few weeks. Yeah.
Wait, so like, we have to like, be able to, like, without any like pictures, like without any like HCL to do anything, just like be able to, like off the top of our head, be like,
like for some instruction, like what value has to end up here?
Okay.
That sort of information. Yeah.
Will you be drawing from the diagrams we've already seen in class, or would you be presenting us with ones that we have?
We probably will not have a diagram.
Okay.
We'll probably just say, you know, there's a data memory, what's its input going to be for this instruction, or where is it going to come from, how is it, that sort of thing. Or is it used by this instruction?
It will be like, does pop Q use data memory? So what is the input?
That sort of thing, yeah.
Okay.
Similar to some questions we had on quizzes, which I will get to. So other questions on exam format and coverage? Okay, so I'll go through exam review, but first, question via anonymous feedback. Multiple people, but everything on the last post quiz was confusing, so sure. Why don't we look at the last post quiz? So if I find the correct quizzes link, that is the correct one, and look at the post quiz, we can talk about the questions that were confusing. So let's start with question one here. So question one, we say in a single cycle processor design that the memory address could become directly from an ALU. And this is the normal case. So if you remember MR move Q and RM move Q, both of these instructions add a value from a register and from the instruction. And that's where the memory address comes from. It's not directly from the instruction or directly from a register. You have to do this addition first. That's why we have the ALU involved. And so for MR move Q and RM move Q, they clearly actually use this ALU to compute exactly the address. So you have our two remaining cases, which are RET and push Q. And for the purpose of this question, RET is the same as pop Q, because we don't care about, because what RET is doing, like pop Q, is popping something from the stack. That's the thing it does with memory and with the ALU. So in both the case of RET and push Q, the ALU is computing the adjustment to the stack pointer. So the difference is what's done with the adjusted value. In both cases, one thing that's done with the adjusted value is that it's written out to the stack pointer again. It goes into that register. But in one case, in the case of push Q, the new value of the stack pointer is actually where we write the value. So it happens to also be computing the address at which we want to store the value. And that's why push Q is not a correct answer. Because yes, we're using the ALU to update the stack pointer, but that update is also our address computation. So we can use the ALU output as the memory address input. In fact, we better, or else what are we going to be putting into the memory address? In the case of RET, we want to use the old value of the stack pointer, the thing that was on top of the stack before we changed it, as the thing we read from memory. And that is not what the ALU is computing. The ALU is computing the updated stack pointer, which is above the thing that we just popped off the stack. So it is not the value we want to send to the data memory. We want to read the address where the stack pointer used to be. So we have this bypass, if you remember, a sequential processor where we had a MUX, and we could take the value directly from the register file. And it was for RET and POPQ.
So yes. Fundamentally, this question basically boils down to the fact that we are just pulling the value off the stack and we're not doing anything to it. So there's no reason to send it through an ALU. It just goes straight over to the...
So the question is, this is because we're pulling a value off the stack and not doing anything to it. So it's a little more subtle than that. So in the case of something like MR move Q, even if your displacement is zero, you can still use the ALU. Right? You could conceptually special case the instruction so you don't, but there's nothing stopping you from using the ALU. The problem is both that we're not doing anything to the value and that we have something else to do with the ALU. So we can't like add zero with the ALU to do this. Because if we added zero with the ALU for RET, then we wouldn't be updating the stack pointer. But for other things, we have that trick that we can like add zero to do nothing but still use the ALU output, which like we saw for IR move Q. That was one way we could implement IR move Q is adding zero, which still uses the ALU even though we didn't need to. We aren't doing anything. But that's a problem for push, for pop and RET, because we actually have something we want to do with the ALU. So other questions? Okay, so let's look at the next question. So some instructions do not use the memory stage. What is true about these instructions? And I'll go through each of these choices since they all fooled a lot of people. So these instructions change the PC, by which I meant the program counter register, but pretty much any other definition of PC works, more quickly than other instructions. So the program counter register changes when the clock cycle rises. The length of the clock cycle is determined by our slowest instruction. We can't actually look at what instruction is running and decide, I'm going to have a faster clock cycle this time. We don't have a mechanism to do that in our processor. So the clock cycle is fixed. It's fixed by how slow the slowest instruction is. This was one of the big disadvantages of our single cycle design, is that we're limited by the slowest instruction. So it doesn't matter that maybe we can compute the PC faster. If that happens to be true, it probably isn't. But if it was, it doesn't help us. We can't actually change it faster. And if you think the PC is based on is the address of the instruction we're currently executing or the next instruction, it's the same. We can't start executing the next instruction until the next rising edge of the clock. Yeah. Yes.
In the book, there were some examples of commands that said what actually happens in the commands. And one of them could say PC equals PC plus 2, another one could say PC equals PC plus 10.
Yeah, so when the book is showing, so the question is that the book shows something like where we have fetch, and we get something, and then we do, and then we say like, maybe we do PC gets PC plus 2 for some instruction. So the issue is what this actually means when we wire up the processor is really that PC register output plus 2 is the PC register input, right? That's what it actually meant when we implemented the processor. Just like if later on in writeback we do RA gets, val m, let's say. This actually means the register file input. Not actually the register. That's what happens within the cycle, and this takes effect when we have the rising edge of the clock. This PC register input does something, and the register file input does something when we have the rising edge of the clock. So, but conceptually, this is what the instruction is doing, but it's doing it, the actual state updates have to happen at the rising edge of the clock. And so something notable about the stages is right now, these stages don't occur, in the order they're listed. The hardware is actually parallel. And we saw in the diagram that clearly the PC update can happen in parallel with like the memory access. But everything can happen in parallel. The only ordering constraints are if we have actual dependencies, if we need a value, say, from the register file before we can do an addition. That's the only sort of ordering the hardware will have. Otherwise, we might write them in a certain order, but they'll occur in whatever order. So, other questions? Okay, so that's PC updates more quickly. So our instruction rate is fixed. And therefore, our rate of updating state, which happens at rising edges of the clock, is fixed. It happens at regular intervals, and how long that interval is determined by our slowest instruction. Because we don't have some mechanism where we can say, what instruction are we executing? If it's a fast one, I want to make the clock go faster. We didn't have that in our processor. And it's actually very hard to build such mechanisms. Not impossible, but very hard, and like an extremely advanced electrical engineering topic. So other thing is when these instructions execute, the address input to the data memory is 0. So let's take a look at our hashing diagram. This is the address input to the data memory. It comes from this mux, which takes an ALU output or a register output. I believe that should be a register output. And for most of these instructions, at least a lot of the time, either the ALU is going to be computing a non-zero value, or register A is going to be reading a non-zero value. That means the value is not going to be zero. It doesn't matter what the value is, because we have these control signals, which determine whether or not the memory actually does something. But the value is very unlikely to be zero, and there's no reason to make it zero. You aren't gaining anything by making it zero. So in this design, just naturally, we're going to send a non-zero value there. Okay. So another question is, when these instructions execute, in an HCL2D implementation, the mem read bit control signal will be zero. So yes, we don't want to read memory for these instructions, so we shouldn't do that. So hopefully, since we're not reading memory, we're setting that control signal to zero so we don't read memory. Otherwise, you have an incorrect implementation. Other possibility is that these instructions all write a value to the register file. So there's a simple counterexample, which is nop. Nop doesn't write a value to the register file. Halt is another one which doesn't write a value to the register file. So they don't. And I assume that that would have been easier given that you had the book, but apparently not. So any questions about any of these options? So then we have, in the single cycle processor design, from which sources could the program counter register input come? So this is, what are we setting the program counter register to? So let me go through the correct answers and what instructions use them. So the most common one is C here, that there's some adder where we add the current PC and the length of the instruction, which I didn't tell you was an input, but adders probably have two inputs. So that's the most common thing we do to compute the next instruction. So then we have two other cases, two instructions which compute the next address to go to in different ways. One of those is jump or call. In the case of jump or call, we get it from the instruction memory. It's part of the instruction. So we take part of the instruction memory output and put it back into the PC. We just copy that destination constant from the instruction into the PC. And the other case is RET. In the case of RET, we pop something from the stack and put it in the PC. And if we're getting it from the stack, it's from memory, so it comes from the data memory output. So for the other ones, so it's true that sometimes some processors let you jump to a register that is not possible in Y86. If it was, then yes, A would be an answer. It's true in some processors, including x86, you can do a jump which is like some register plus something, or some memory address plus something, or something in the instruction plus something, but that's not generally the case in Y86. So the other ones would be true in something like x86, where if we were implementing a bigger instruction set which had more kinds of jumps, or calls, or returns. So any questions about this question? Okay, and finally, which of these things are legal in HCL2D? And this question everyone did, well, has a very bad average. So go through each of them. So for the first one, I think the biggest confusion here is that there's an assumption that signals that are used by the built-in components behave very differently from other signals. They do not. So all wires in HCL2D behave the same. The only thing that's special about the built-in wires are two things. So one is that if they're an input wire, their input is used by a built-in component. If they're an output wire, they're set by a built-in component, so you should not set them yourselves. And for some of the input wires, there's something happens if you don't set the value to give it a default. But otherwise, the rules are the same. And the rules for wires are that the bit widths must match, that you must assign to them the correct number of times. You can only assign the value once, but you can use it as many times as you like. And that's true of all these. So yes, I can set reg source A. I can't set reg source A to PC, but that's not because they're input wires. So the reason I can't do this is because reg source A is a register number. So it's the index of a register that's a 4-bit number, and PC is an address that we pass to the instruction memory that's a 64-bit number. They're not compatible. But reg input E, which is a 64-bit input to the register file, and PC are compatible, and it doesn't matter that other things happen to be using these values. We're allowed to use PC, again, just like the instruction memory is allowed to use it. It doesn't matter that the value is used twice, and we're allowed to certainly set reg input E to something. Now, in the case of this example here, which is legal, of wire A, B, so there was one piece of confusion which we might drop the question for, which is that the HCL to D document says you can't use a wire in the same line it's defined. They meant like statement, so not including semicolons. If I had realized that people would do that, I would make this question and this question be multiple lines. But I didn't realize that that was in there and would confuse people that way. But ignoring the issue of how many lines we've written this on, here we're defining two wires, and we're assigning A to B and B to 4. And remember, in HCL to D, it doesn't matter the order we assign things in. It just matters that you assign exactly once if you want a value to be set. Yes? Yes, so these eights, colon eights here mean that each of these wires is 8-bit wide. So other questions?
If the value set B equal to was bigger than 8 bits, that give an error?
That would be an error, yes. So in HCL to D, it is strict about bit width agreement. The bit widths must exactly agree. They can't be bigger, they can't be smaller.
But then if it's less than, if it's less than 8 bits, then it'll be padded out with zeros.
So the question is, if it's less than 8 bits, will we pad it out with zeros? No, it will not. The value 4, that's fine. So constants that do not explicitly specify all their bits are set to can be any width you want. But wire values must agree exactly. Sorry. Misunderstanding your question. Okay. So the second example here, this wire A is 64 bits, and that's set A equal to I10 bytes, bits 2 through 8. That's a bit width disagreement. We're taking 6 bits from I10 bytes and trying to use it to set 64 bits. HCL to D doesn't allow that. It doesn't pad it with zeros. It just says, no, you can't do that. If you want to pad it with zeros, there's a way of doing that explicitly, which is in the HCL to D page. I didn't show it in lecture. Yes?
If wires A and B were 1-bit wide and you tried to set it to 4, would that be an error?
I believe that would be an error, yes. Yes, if these were 1-bit wide and we try to set it to 4, we try to set it to, instead of 4, something that's bigger than 256. And the final thing here is setting reg source A, which is a register number, to 3. That is perfectly legal. 3 is a valid register number that we can set things to. Okay, any questions on anything on this quiz? Yeah.
Why A is invalid?
So reg source A is a 4-bit register number, and PC is a 64-bit address that the instruction memory uses. So that's 4 and 64 bits. We can't assign them to each other. Yes?
And A is invalid because you can set the register, get source index to like any number you want it to be?
So E is valid because 3 fits in 4 bits, and constants have whatever width they need to have. And you can set reg source A to, it's an input, you can set it to whatever you want that fits in the size. Yeah?
Can you repeat like what you're actually doing when you're setting 4-bit register value? What is that?
So if we set reg source A to 3, this means that reg output A is going to be the value of the third register, or the fourth register, I should say. Which we could look up in a table what that is. I don't have it memorized. So this affects what reg output A will be, which is why you do that. Typically, you'd set it to actually part of the instruction. OK, so that's our review through the quiz. So I want this guy. I want this window. OK. So for the rest of class, which is apparently way less time than I thought, yeah. Sorry.
Suppose you do an operation on a wire. Would that fill up the rest of the bits? Or can you run it into like another wire with a different number of bits?
So the question is, can you do like, and do like B equals A plus 16? I think this is illegal, but I'm not sure. I think you need to do something like however many zeros you need to make the signal wide enough. I'm not sure, actually. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
If you assign, say, A to, if like A was 64 and B was 64, and then you assign, never mind.
Okay. So now that I've done quiz review and we apparently have not as much time left as I thought we would, let's. What things would people like me to go over for the exam? Like questions, I will take as specific or non-specific. Yes.
RISC versus CISC.
RISC versus CISC. Okay. I'm just going to collect these and then for a minute and then go through them. Other things? Yes. Clock cycle. Okay. Yes. ISA trade-offs. Okay. Yeah.
What program registers are written in red by like pop push?
Register. Pop push. Okay. Other topics. I also will accept more specific questions. Yes.
Register.
Register attributes.
So as in like the different flags, like read bit and like. Source input, like how you actually interact.
Oh, register file control signals?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
There were some questions on the past exams that said like byte I is equal to like I plus 0x20. Do you remember those questions?
And then okay.
And then it would say something like what's in EAX if we do like as what?
Okay. Yeah. Endianness memory access questions. Anything else? So I will group some of these. So RISC versus CISC and ISA trade-offs go together. Register file control signals and clock cycle go together. Others are here. So RISC versus CISC. So the key idea for RISC is that it's reduced complexity for the implementer. It is not for the implementer of the processor. It is actually not easier for the compiler because there's less stuff that the compiler can do and has to do the same amount of things using less stuff. So that's the key idea of RISC. So that's reduced complexity for the implementer in exchange versus more convenience for compiler writers, assembler writers. So if you remember, Samir had this concept of semantic gap, which is how close the ISA is to the real language, like C or Java, et cetera. And this is big for RISC. Deliberately big, because they're making the hardware easier and assuming that whoever implements the compiler and deals with that gap is going to do more work. So if you want to know if something, is RISC, this is the rule of thumb, which usually works. The one exception is that RISC, that typically more registers and things like that. Why? Do something with extra hardware space. So you have the same amount of space to implement a RISC processor as a CISC one. One thing you can do is add more registers. That's sort of the conceptual idea behind it. And hopefully you can make up for not having as much of the sort of complex instructions that someone might want using that thing, which is less complex for you to do. It's just adding the same thing, you have more copies of the same thing you already have. Yeah.
So this would make it easier for the compiler and for the hardware?
So adding more registers makes it easier for the compiler to be fast. Otherwise it doesn't change very much, right? Because the compiler still needs to handle not having enough registers in either case.
So it'll make the hardware more complex, so it's just like the flow.
So this makes the hardware, more complex, but not nearly, it's not actually that much more complex because you're basically making more copies of something you already have. So it's not much extra work to add more registers, it's just extra hardware. Versus, it's a lot of extra work to add a new type of instruction. Yes? So for example, RISC processors typically don't have push-pop. This is something that's just very convenient in many languages for implementing like function calls. In RISC processors, they just don't implement it. And we saw in Y86 that they're pretty complicated, and that's why. So they're making their lives easier, but now the compiler needs to synthesize a sequence of instructions for push-pop. And there are also other sorts of instructions, like there might be insert on linked list instruction. And that's easier for compiler, but much harder to implement. So these are things which are closer to what the high level language wants that you might have as instructions. So the gap is like how much extra work do you need to do to translate the high-level things where you like save a value on a stack. So in a RISC processor, that's going to be multiple things, whereas in x86, we have a way to do that. Or versus like operate on a linked list. In VAX, you had a way to do that. In other processors, you generally have to synthesize a sequence of instructions to do it. Yeah. So the question is, with a CISC processor, the compiler can optimize more? The answer is probably it's a wash. There's not actually a particular difference. The compiler has more options in a CISC processor, but that doesn't necessarily mean it can make things faster. Okay. And so the key ISA trade-offs are going to be sort of how much time it takes to make your hardware, and versus sort of how expensive, how big an area and or power, etc. the hardware is. Those are trade-offs which also affect instruction sets. So having more registers means that you're bigger in area and power. Having more complex addressing modes means you're bigger in area from the logic to handle that. But the other part of this trade-off is the size of programs. So RISC is typically more machine code for the same program, whereas CISC-like is less machine code for the same program. And the big factor that does this is variable versus non-variable length versus fixed length and number of addressing modes. So more addressing modes means that you can do more types of things in one instruction, which means you tend to have less instructions. Variable length encoding means that your shorter, simpler instructions actually take up less space. Yeah.
What does feed, is one faster than the other?
So the question is one faster than the other? You can't really answer that question without knowing what programs you're running. And the short answer is, in practice, it doesn't seem like it. Yeah.
Just to clarify, the addressing modes, are those basically like you're going from a register to, what is that?
Addressing modes, so are like, these things are addressing modes. So having more addressing modes, let's hope, probably makes programs shorter. Just because if you want 100 RAX RVX, you're going to read out a few extra instructions. Okay. So any other questions about ISA trade-offs? Sorry, this is rather ad hoc. Okay, so yeah. Okay. So on the clock cycle and control signals. So the clock cycle, what happen, things that happen at the rising edge of the clock. Block. So who can name some things that happen at the rising edge of the clock? PC updates. So PC register updates.
Register file update or?
So register file values update. Stored values. The values stored in the register files. Basically, this is all registers update. Memory, data memory completes write. So all our state updates happen at the rising edge of the clock.
What condition code fall under register update?
Yes. Code register update. So when we implement condition codes later, we will use a register to store them. So that also falls under things that happen at the rising edge of the clock. So things that happen as values are available. All computation. So all that computation, like the ALU, it takes in some values and eventually its output is some other values within a clock cycle. And reading registers from the register file and reading memories. So these are all things which happen in a clock cycle. So all our state updates, things that are permanent changes, happen at the rising edge of the clock. Everything else, the things that happen within one instruction that don't persist, happen within the clock cycle as values are available. Yes?
Doesn't the data memory use the files out that are outputted from the register file itself?
Yes. So the register stored values update at the rising edge of the clock. Reading registers happens as the values are available.
So then how does the data memory write values if it hasn't had a chance to read the value from the register file yet?
It completes the write at the rising edge of the clock. So the data memory, the question is, how does the data memory do the write if the values, so which values are we talking about here?
So you're saying that the data memory completes the write at the rising edge of the clock.
Yes.
But you're saying that you read all the registers in the middle of the clock cycle.
Yeah, so
how does data memory pull the value from the register file to complete
So the data memory is gonna get some values, say, from which we're gonna start at the registers within a clock cycle, then go through the ALU, computing an address, and that's gonna be the input to the data memory. And at the following rising edge of the clock, that's when the data memory does its write. So conceptually, this is at the rising edge of the clock. This is at, we can think of this as being end of a clock cycle.
Okay, thank you.
Which also is the beginning of the next clock cycle. But as far as what values are being changed, it's the ones from that clock cycles, you, it's probably easier to think of it as the end. Okay, so the other part of this is the register file control signals, which I grouped in with here because knowing when that happens is awfully important. So the register file has, so register numbers. So register file input, that input outputs. So we have source A and input and output A, source B, output B, dest E, input E, dest M, input M. So this is register number value as to write, read value read out, read this cycle, or to write at next clock, rising edge. So we have these four pairs. So we have source A, which is controls what output A is, what register is output, and that's within this clock cycle. Source B, same for output B, and we have to inputs and corresponding register numbers. So destination E says what register do we write at the next rising edge, and input E is the value to write to that. Same with destination M and input M. Yes.
How big are those fields?
What?
How big are those fields?
So how big are these is the question. So this is 4 bits and 64 bits. So it's 4 bits because they have register numbers 0 through 14 inclusive, and register number 15 we also use for the none value. Any questions about these control signals or clock cycles? Yes.
Which number would correspond to like RDX or RCX?
The question is which number corresponds to RDX or RCX? I do not remember, and we will certainly tell you any register numbers you actually need.
So going back to like all the way back to the Y86 opcodes, like when the registers are in the next set of bits,
yeah,
then you'll tell us which register corresponds to.
Yeah, so if you need to know register numbers, we will tell you what register numbers you, the register numbers you need to know. We'll either give you the table or we'll tell you like RBX is whatever. Okay, so register is written and read by pop and push. So let's start with pop. What does pop do? So first, so pop reads the value at the current stack pointer into, so let's say pop RX. So RX, register RX gets memory at the current stack pointer, and also the current stack pointer is incremented by 8. So these are the two registers that are written by pop. And also pop needs to read from RSP because we actually use the value for RSP, in fact, for two things, to increment and to read from memory. Yes?
Which ones are written by pop?
The ones RSP is read by pop, because we need to know the address to use. And register X, I should write this consistently. And the register that's an argument to pop is written by pop in addition to RSP. Because that's where the result of pop goes. So those are two registers being read, being written by RSP and one register being read. In the case of push, it's almost the same. Except we write a value to memory at RSP minus 8 from a register and also update RSP. So in this case, we're reading from RX and RSP, exactly the opposite, and writing only to RSP. Yes?
Well, why don't you switch the instructions, the order of them, and then just do write it RSP without the minus 8?
So the question is, why did I write RRSP minus 8 in the memory end here? I just did that to be consistent with what I wrote before.
With your what?
I just wrote this in the same order I wrote this.
Okay.
Just to be consistent. Yeah. It's not that you couldn't do that.
Oh, so if they were swapped, it wouldn't matter?
If they were swapped, well, I would probably need to say, I would want to write in a way where it's clear when the RSP gets updated.
Okay.
This also is a little better reflection of what actually happens, because remember, this was a case where we computed a value in an ALU and used that as the memory address and the new value of RSP. And you can, this more clearly shows that we're computing a value and using it, not that we somehow update RSP in the middle of the instruction, which we can't do. Because that's not how registers step dates work. They have all happen at the next rising edge of the clock. Yes, back there? I would say we're reading one register, which is usually how we'll try to, we will try to not phrase it so that matters, because yes, a technique we saw used was reading RSP twice from two outputs, which you don't have to do, but you could do. That's what our textbook authors do for that. Yeah. So if we ask the question, we will say that we will phrase it in a way where that doesn't matter. Okay, and finally, endianness and memory access questions. So typically, I believe this is referring to questions which are like saying, let's say we have memory that looks like this, that this is what's in memory. So, and we might ask various questions based on this. So one question is, what's this memory look like? What if I have this in memory and I do move L from address, this is x86, just because this is more text in y86. Move L from address 103, or let's say, let's start with the simple one. From address 100 to EAX, what value is in EAX? So I've listed here the bytes of memory. So this is a move L. This is, L is 32 bits. EAX is also 32 bits. So you have two ways of knowing it's 32 bits, which is 4 bytes. So I need all the bytes listed here, all 4 of those bytes. And I need to get one number from that. And we have, remember our rule is that x86 is little endian, so the first byte is the least significant part. That means it goes last in English order. So we're gonna the first byte is last in English order, second byte is second to last in English order, and then so on. So this is the number we will read. Yeah?
So you'll specify, if you have this question, whether or not we're in x86 or y86 to change that accordingly.
The answer is the same for x86 or y86, except for what instructions are valid. Like, there's no move L in y86.
Oh, right.
But if I ask this question about MR move Q, I could ask the same question. And it works exactly the same way. So the other version of this question we might ask is, let's say I have some value and I move it to memory at address 102. What does memory change to? And so to do this, you need to know, what's this going to write to memory? So this is going to write, it's move L, so it's going to write 4 bytes again. I could probably do this with a move Q to be, since for this case it won't matter. So it's going to write, if it's move Q, it's going to write 8 bytes, so 102, 103, 104, 105, all the way down to 10A, because it writes 8 bytes. And we're in little endian order, so the least significant part is first, the least significant part is last in English order, so that's CD. So at address 102, you'll write CD, then AB, and then we keep going, and there's zeros at the beginning of any number. We still write 8 bytes, because it's a move queue. So you write zeros all the way to here. And if we have this change up here, that's going to be OXCD, OXAB. And that would change what would happen if we, say, ran that move L again. Yes?
So the constants, we interpret them as being written in B and N.
In English, we write the most significant part first.
Okay,
because that's how English works, okay. And that's what our assembly language uses.
So whenever we look at a problem and there's a constant, and we assume it's written in the English order, and then in memory it's represented in the little endian order.
Yeah, the bytes are in little endian.
Okay.
Like we notice that we aren't changing the order of things within a byte because we can't actually subdivide the bytes. Yes.
Can you explain why it's 10A, counting 8 bytes, just to make sure that I'm counting?
No, I probably have an off by one error, and that should be 109.
Okay.
Sorry, I can't add. Well, go that way. Okay. So questions about this? Sort of, this is probably how I would go about solving the problem, is figure out what's in the relevant bytes of memory. Like, just write it out, byte by byte. And the biggest confusion that people seem to have is that they really want, if we give you a value which only has non-zero things in 2 bytes, to only write 2 bytes. But that's not what move Q or move L does. You know, it's going to write out 8 bytes or 4 bytes, depending on the type of move. Or it's going to read that many bytes. You know, so if we move L from 102, it's going to read 102, 103, 104, 105. It's not going to stop because we didn't tell you about the other bytes. You should remember that you need those extra bytes. Yes?
In the memory addressing mode of like the constant, then parentheses, and then percent register, so like a displacement of that register, when it asks what's the value in that, if EAX has memory value 7, right, 0 and 7, and then we have the expression 2% and then EAX.
So the question is, if you have 2% EAX and it asks,
are we getting the value, and then EAX contains 0x7, are we getting the value at 0x9, or are we just getting 0x9?
So this means memory at 2 plus value in EAX, at address, at the address 2 plus the value.
So you add the 2 and then you do reference.
And then you do reference that, and you need to know how big it is, which you'll learn from the instruction or some context in the question.
And the dereferences from the parentheses around the EAX.
The dereferencing?
Like,
so this parentheses, so the question is, how is dereferencing represented in assembly?
Yeah.
So in AT&T syntax, parentheses always means this is referring to something in memory.
Okay.
That's computed using a register. So, other questions for today? There will be a screen recording, and I will also try to post the text file.
All the registers are block registers. So there's definitely a distinction between.